The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
I appreciated the things you handed in, the homework. I'm going to run through and just make a few comments. Melinda, where are you? Yeah. Your one on fish I liked a lot because it was a very novel observation. It really surprised me. She talked about a pet fish that she had kept isolated in a separate tank from her other fish. And the fish seemed to have become rather attached to her. Now, how did she know that? Well, it came to her, came to the front when she came there. Well, you see that in many fish. This could be associated with being rewarded by being fed, right? But then she saw something very different. She was there once with her boyfriend, and the fish indicated that it was jealous of the boyfriend. Now, whether this was real or not raises real questions, but the behavior she described, and she repeated, like a true scientist, she repeated it several times. I have never heard of this with fish before. You certainly find that with other pets. There would be many questions. One is, how young was the fish when you put it in that tank by itself? How much time did you spend with it? It raises very interesting questions. I think you should look at the literature on that species and see if you can find anything. See what's known about it. Phil wrote a very interesting paper on an observation he made of a California condor. He was working on a conservation project trying to preserve the condors in California. And his job at this point was to take care of a sick condor. And he was supposed to be giving it some medicine. So he put the medicine in the entrails of a rat. These are scavengers, right? They'll eat dead animals. And he put it in on a perch. And all the condor had to do was come from one perch to another. But there was a barrier in between. But of course, the condor was very familiar with this area it had been living. And what did the condor do? He came directly for the dead rat and ran right into the barrier. It's like he couldn't do the elementary thing of going around the barrier. That's called detour behavior. The question is, why wouldn't the condor show detour behavior? Well, in fact, it's a problem with many animals. For one thing, condors never face barriers like that in their natural environment. At least it's difficult to think of situations where they would. That may be part of the problem, and he mentions that possibility in his write-up. And the other thing is, would the animal, if it was, what happened was, after leaving it in there a long, long time, the condor eventually, probably by wandering around the fence, found his way to the rat and ate it. But the point is, it didn't initially, was not able to do the detour. And you find that very commonly. You see dogs that will struggle to get through a fence for a long period of time. Animals will try to get through a glass barrier. A frog, if faced with a fence that's between it and a worm, is very interesting. It won't flick his tongue through the fence. It'll sidestep, then flick its tongue. It's an innate behavior pattern. It's built in the frogs and toads to do that. Apparently, it's not built into the condor. So it's very interesting questions. And I imagine the condor could be taught, but of course we don't know that without doing the experiments. Yes?
What kind of barrier?
A piece of a chain link fence.
If it were something like glass, you understand?
Yeah.
A little more wide.
Well, like glass, you can see through the fence.
Very much like the frog, you see, and yet the frog, if, at least if the barrier is made of vertical sticks, will step around it. I think it has to be vertical. It's got that sidestepping behavior, and there's some evidence that rats and other small mammals have that also. It's a function of one part of the subcortical visual system. Kua wrote about the animal that most of you would not have encountered in growing up. It's about a monkey in Ghana, right? And at the tender age of 10 years, she noticed the incredible sociality of these animals and how they responded to each other, how they had a complex organization. And she mentions one thing that I would like to know more about. She said they could communicate by means of their facial markings. That's all she said, and I would like to know more about that. I don't know if you can say any more about that.
I know that they use it as a means of recognizing one another, but I actually did more research on that. But apparently, I can't seem to find anything that goes into real depth of it. You might find writing home or contacting
others. Sure.
Because I don't even think of it. But I know they can recognize each other with the markings, but I'm not exactly sure how the communication comes into play. It's sort of being able to recognize one another.
Right. These are Mona monkeys, you said?
Yes.
And I don't know of any behavioral studies either. But yeah, it would be interesting to try to find them out. Could you pass the back to Ashley wrote about geese. Encountering geese while she was running. Right? She found that they didn't give way. There's a whole lot of geese and they're young on the path, and she tried to run right through them with some difficulty, is that right? And they still didn't give way. Actually, you were lucky. You probably went through rather quickly or you would have been attacked. You know? I don't know what to suggest. You said you felt bad when you tried next by hissing at them. See, they hiss when they're aggressive. So she tried hissing at them. And they did give way just enough so she could get by some reason. She didn't try what Conrad Lawrence does in the film we'll see on Friday, namely have his assistants use their arm to be like the neck of the goose in the position they use for aggressive behavior. And it would be interesting. Of course, you also may find that a dominant gander takes your challenge seriously and attacks. But most of them would give way in that situation. It depends on their experience with humans. But anyway, it's a very interesting paper. Another one on geese by Taub. And feeding the geese that live by the BU Bridge here, and she asked a very good question. She wondered whether the geese could learn who's who. Some people feed them, some people don't. Would they learn to recognize the ones that feed them and the ones that don't? The answer is, from all we know from many studies by Conrad Lawrence and others, is that yes, they would learn. But she remembered chickens when she was growing up, chickens that they kept. I don't remember this when my parents kept chickens when I was a little kid. I come from a farm family, but I didn't grow up on the farm, but they did. So they kept chickens for a while. But she said the chickens behaved very differently with her father than with her and her mother. Well, her father fed them. Let's see. And they would run up to him, but ignore her and her mother. So it's a very good question about individual, not just about what they could learn, but about individual recognition, which we also mentioned in the case of the monkeys. And there's a lot of evidence that many birds, the more social birds anyway, have individual recognition. And it's often visual in the case of birds. In the case of dogs, it may be olfactory as well as visual. And maybe auditory as well. I'm not sure we know. Then there was one about the cat by Katie and about an interesting behavior that a pet cat showed. She calls it kneading behavior, where the cat that gets on a soft quilt does this kind of thing, paws, seems to be kneading the quilt. And she relates it quite rightly, I think, to behavior that newborn kittens or very young kittens show when they're nursing. They do this to the breast of the mother to stimulate milk flow. And it could be that. It could be left over from that. But then she describes how it had developed the habit of doing this to people's hair. In other words, it treated it as friendly behavior, so friendly social behavior. I imagine that it persisted in that cat because it had never been strongly discouraged from it. But it is an innate behavior pattern of cats. Yes?
I've read some studies that suggest that cats taken away from their mothers too early are much more likely to continue needing throughout their lives.
Very, very good. Yeah. I would have guessed that, but I don't know that study. Did you hear that? Yeah. So it would depend on when they take it from their mother, yes?
It seems like when they're doing that, they often reach their claws, like they'll do this sort of thing with their claws. But do they do that to their mother? It seems like that
they use their claws, but they don't actually cause injury, you know. Yes, they do that because it stimulates. They need to produce the tactile sensations in order to stimulate milk flow. That's right. Okay, Carlos wrote a paper about a dog that's very interesting because of a particular question he asks. This was about a little dog that, when he was a little kid, just suddenly, out of the blue, just adopted his group of friends. Is that right? And it is quite surprising how social are these animals, and what was different about this animal that it would just suddenly, with one encounter where he was treated in a friendly way, attach itself to a group of humans.
You know what happens? I would just give him like a piece of food real quick, and he would follow me and my brothers.
Yeah, probably was hungry for one thing, but another thing is that the dog probably had not socialized just with dogs, as some fairly wild city dogs will do. This is a dog that probably had been born with around humans, you know, and must have lost them or become separated, you know, and it was to have it assume that quick an attachment. I would suggest that it probably was right at that period in its life when that was going to happen no matter what. But anyway, it's an interesting question. And there was another one on dogs here by Lisa about, and this was a very different kind of question, a tiny little dog that challenged or barked at two large dogs, Rottweilers, and is that right? Yeah, and she calls this little animal one of the most idiotically courageous animals she ever encountered, and that is right. There's this tiny little chihuahua-like dog appear to be challenging two big Rottweilers. Why would a dog do that? Can it see how big these animals are? So my first question would be, what were their sexes?
The little one was a boy, and I'm not sure what the neighbors are, but I think one's a boy, one's a girl.
Okay. The male dogs will always challenge like that, but it's usually a bluff, and they will quickly give in if they're overwhelmed. You know, but that's very common because they're all the same species and they interact. Very large dogs, Great Danes, will interact with tiny little dogs. And they'll even try to mate and things like that. You know. But it's interesting that because of the instincts of these animals, they can appear to us to behave so foolishly. You know. Okay, just have two more. One about a pigeon and one about bees. The one about the pigeon is different from the others because he talks about observations of a pigeon that say something about the locomotor capacity of this bird. That in order to go, it actually went down a stairway and hopped, making little movements of its wing, but didn't fly down. Is that right? Yeah. Hop down steps. Now, steps pose a particular challenge to animals because they're not, it's not part of their usual environment. I mean, if they're from a rocky area, like mountain goats, they're very good at steps. You know, but a pigeon, when they're walking on the ground, they're usually walking on flat ground, you know. And hopping will be done by some birds, and walking will be done by others. The goose has particular problems with stairways. I mean, you keep pet geese, you find that out when they're in your house. So that it raises many issues about the locomotor capacities of animals based on fixed action patterns combined with learning. And they're limited in the number of movements that they have. And then Lauren wrote about an encounter that she and her mother had with bees. And they had a problem getting rid of bees that they found had occupied, were going in and out of a tiny little hole in a post in a porch. And my question about this story is, first of all, what kind of bee was it? Was it kind of wasp or hornet? Hornets will occupy small areas like that, and they will create nests too. Some of them will have a nest hanging from a tree, but they have to enter through one small opening like that. But you say, in addition, that they drill holes in the wood. And that I'm really unfamiliar with. I wish you would find out what kind of bee could do that. Or were they just discovering other holes that you didn't know about?
No, because when we plug, if somehow have, we never saw them like actually bore the hole, and they were just normal looking bees, like they were looking for
things. Those are wasps.
Okay. And every time we would plug the hole, right next to it, we find a new hole.
Another hole. That's amazing to me. I wish you'd look. You could look at E.O. Wilson's Insect Societies, where he talks a lot about different kinds of bees, but you'll also probably find web information on bees. And homeowners are always concerned about this, so you'll probably find something on the web. And find out for us what bees can actually drill holes in wood. You know. Okay. Anyway, very interesting. We got started with Conrad Lorenz. Now, the reason I've given you Lorenz and Tinbergen to read here at the beginning of the class is because of the importance of these men in the history of animal behavior study. And they were extremely good observers of animals. Tinbergen in particular was a very good experimenter. In addition, Lorenz also did experiments, although he was focused on a particular kind of observation where he interacted with the animals. They say Lorenz could talk to animals, and he could. He learned to imitate sounds of many animals. I wanted to go back to this one question about computer simulations just briefly, because I'm not sure I mentioned one of the key issues in the use of computer simulations that's not been applied much for study of animal behavior at all. And that is when you have a theory that involves interactions, dynamic interactions of different activities. You have more than one rule, in other words, applying, which is certainly true for animal behavior. You often don't know what's predicted. It's too complex. Even when you take a simple kind of interaction of two axons growing, and let's say the only rule they're following is that when one hits the other, a certain percentage of the time it will withdraw, change direction, and start growing again. That's the only rule. So the question is, what does that predict about the pattern of axon growth? In the literature, people claim different things. The fact was, without a simulation, they didn't know. Even such a simple rule, I simulated it with a lot of help from computer guy here, and I found out that it depends on the withdrawal distance of the axon and the probability, but mostly that distance. And it makes total difference in the pattern of axon growth. So with behavior, you can expect even greater variety. In other words, you can't predict what your own theory suggests without the help of computers in many cases. That's something that I don't think is appreciated very much in the study of animal behavior, and it's the reason why computer people have not been much part of the study of animal behavior to this point. So I would say animal behavior from that standpoint, from the standpoint of comprehensive theory of motivated behavior, is really in its infancy. Okay. Okay, now we started the... This was the last thing about the interrelationship of innate and acquired behavior. Did anyone try to answer this? Why would we expect care of young, which we call brood tending in animal behavior, to be largely innate in many animal species? Why would it almost have to be? That's the first question. The second question is, well, okay, you have a brood-tending situation. How could you find out just what's learned and what's not? How could you find out if something is learned? So the first question is, why would you expect it to be largely innate? What does this suggest in the book?
Well, like, by the time you're of age to reproduce, not going to have your parents come to teach you how to take care of your young.
Yeah. In many animals, that's right. The first time they ever encounter young is when they give birth. You know? So if they didn't know what to do by their inbuilt behavior, they wouldn't be able to take care of them. And that's a very simple reason. That's right. But don't assume that it's purely innate, because in most cases it isn't. How would you get evidence that an animal in his brood tending also depended on learning, at least to some degree? What would you look for? Yeah.
Some inbred animals are very bad at taking care of their own young.
Okay, that's the first one. Some hand-reared animals are very bad at taking care of young. I wouldn't look at that as sufficient, because hand rearing could also alter the innate pattern in other ways, so you may have got a degradation of what would be there in an animal reared more normally with its parents. Anything else? Yes?
If the rearing success increases the experience.
Very good. Okay. They get better over time if they're learning something. I've observed many, many dozens of hamsters rearing their young, and the first litter, they're not as good taken care of. You can make a very simple measure, like the number of injuries to those little pups, because they handle them too roughly. I can count the injuries. They decrease by the second litter, from the second litter to the first. Okay? And it does affect survival, but there it's not a good... I don't want to depend on my statistics for survival of the pups, because the first litter is usually smaller than the later ones. Okay, but if you look at just percentage, you probably get a larger percentage, but I'm really not sure, because when there's a larger number, more of them will also die. So I can't be sure of it, but I can be sure that they change with experience. And there's a big difference between the way they treat their pups on the first day and the way they treat them several days later. Does that mean experience? Not necessarily. It may only mean that in the case of hamsters, they don't reach a peak of maternal behavior until a few days after birth. But does that make any sense? In the case of hamsters, it does, because hamsters are born on the 13th, the late on the 15th day of gestation, whereas all other species, including ones they must have evolved from, have a slightly longer gestation period. It's part of the way hamsters have adapted to having larger litters, to have be born in such an immature state. So they make, and studies show that if you take pups at various ages, day zero, day one, day two, day three, and put them with animals that have never had, with primiferous animals, they've never had, okay, you put them with virgin females and just see how they respond. The pups, when they're a few days old, elicit more maternal behavior than they do at birth. Okay. Well, the pups of a few days old, that's just at the age when most, like rats and mice, are born. Okay. Okay, so it's a little bit complicated, but there is both innate and learned components, but the basic pattern of behavior for most animals is built in. Yeah.
So actually, I think if you observe, say, different strategies of taking care of the individual population, then you can be more certain that probably that's harmful.
Very good. That's the other thing we should mention, just looking at variability of brood tending within species. That's right. Yes?
So if brood tending is induced, then why sometimes do the mothers eat their babies?
Why do mothers sometimes eat their babies? That's a good question. And it's one we can at least partially answer, say for hamsters. People say hamsters are horrible animals. They sometimes eat their babies. But I can tell you, the reason they eat them, it's the ones that are being horrible are the humans taking care of them. Here's what they do. They're curious about the babies. They'll pick up the cage, look at them, and sometimes they'll put it back in a different position. What do you think that does to the mother? Something that never happens to her in the wild. And when you change the position of a cage, you've disturbed her orientation. The nest might be in the wrong place now. And she sees it as this little group of foreigners that have somehow invaded her territory. It might take her, especially if she's a new mother, to regain her orientation towards her own nest. It can take a little while. Yes, David.
One, if they smell many animals, I don't know which ones, if it's an animal picked up and it smells different, then they'll eat it, or if it's a form, they'll eat it because it probably won't survive.
In many cases, even though the claim is just what you say, that if you handle babies, the mothers will eat them. That's usually not the reason, though. Behaviorists like Lawrence and others have often handled babies, and it doesn't cause eating in every case. Species differ somewhat, but often there's other kinds of disturbances that affect it. You know, I've discovered that if you remove hamsters from baby hamsters from their mother for a long enough period, that if it's not an experienced mother, if you keep them out too long, she loses her maternal behavior, and you put them back, and suddenly they're like crickets, the nest of crickets you put in her, and she will treat them with attack. She will attack them as if they're crickets or grass, and hamsters attack crickets normally and eat them. We think of them as seed-eating animals, but in fact they're omnivores, and they will attack small creatures, and those poor little pups can be killed like that, but by a mother who has, she switched instincts. She switched from her maternal instinct to a different one. She's not being a horrible mother or a horrible animal. Okay? She's got, just like Lawrence talked about the disturbed jackdaws that are behaving strangely because of the way they were reared. Well, here they're behaving strangely because of a disturbance. Okay? The sensory configuration has changed. All right. Now, this is a question that came up when we were talking about the things you guys wrote. Describe evidence for individual recognition among jackdaws of a colony, and how do we know they can recognize individual humans? Both things were dealt with in the Lawrence chapter. Can someone answer the first part? What's the evidence that they recognize each other? Very good evidence, and it's very simple. Yeah?
Social hierarchy.
They have a pecking order. And what Jack does, it's very stable. You know, they recognize each other perfectly. You know? And if a female jackdaw suddenly pairs with a dominant male jackdaw, her position is suddenly elevated. And within a rather short period of time, all the jackdaws in the colony recognize her new status. And that happens in many primates as well. And Lawrence describes it there. They clearly recognize each other. Of course, we think it's mostly visual, but it's also auditory. They recognize calls. How do we know they can recognize individual humans? There's a number of incidents in the Lawrence chapter that describe individual recognition. Okay. The clearest one is the way jackdaws learn. An enemy of jackdaws. Yes? Go ahead.
Okay. They're saying, like, if you were holding, like, some kind of, like, black thing, or, like, if you're holding one like that, they make like, an alarm sound.
Yeah, if you're around jackdaws, if you pick up something that's sort of dangling black. In black,
yeah.
You will get attacked. Even if it's your favorite pet jackdaw that seems to know you very well, you know, he describes how he discovered that. He had been swimming, and he had his wet bathing trunks in his pocket. He was walking back from the River Danube, and he pulls that bathing trunks out. So suddenly there he is holding this wet bathing suit, black bathing suit, and he got attacked by his pet jackdaw. And he found out that if he handled a young jackdaw, the same thing would happen. But the point is that they not only get attacked in this innate behavior pattern showing an enemy of jackdaws, but they remember that person. And it's passed on also to other jackdaws. And he describes that in his chapter. And if it happens several times, they will remember over generations that a person, one particular person, is to be avoided. And they will mob that person and everything. Okay, we'll talk about mobbing behavior in a minute. Anyway, lots of evidence for that just from the observations of jackdaw colonies. Here's one that certainly involves individual recognition. We know about peacocks and how the male peacock displays to win a female. Yes, there's a question. Sorry?
I think we may have skipped.
Oh, yeah. I meant to do this one first and I skipped over. Okay, well, we talked about an innate component of recognizing predators a minute ago, and that's the only innate behavior that Lawrence described in his early period with jackdaws, of recognizing a predator enemy. So any animal that is seen by other jackdaws carrying a dead jackdaw or a struggling jackdaw would be recognized by all the jackdaws as an enemy of jackdaws. They would mob it, they would disturb it as much as they can, and they would remember it. So they learn that foxes and other animals that will catch jackdaws are enemies. So there you have one innate reaction, and then the learn component, where because it spreads to other members of the colony, even if they didn't initially experience that predator or predator-like animal or human carrying the dangling black thing. Okay, so well, we should have done that first, and then the individual recognition thing. Okay, now the thing about thank you for calling my attention to that. the visual appearance of a peacock male displaying to win a female is incredibly striking. And it's unmistakable when he's courting, because he fans out his feathers. People love to take pictures of displaying male peacocks. That's redundant. It's peahen would be the female, peacock is the male. Okay. What about jackdaws? They don't have all this fancy plumage. So when a young male jackdaw falls in love, how does he try to get the attention of one particular female and win a positive response? He does. How does he do it? Go ahead. He struts and displays visually, and he makes particular sound. There's more, yeah.
The stronger jackdaw to show that he has courage, and he kind of shows the body gesture, kind of challenge the dominant jackdaw when the female's looking to the head.
Yeah, not necessarily the dominant, but another jackdaw that's showing interest, he will challenge. But he will do that particularly if the other female's there. If she's not, he won't bother. You know, why take unnecessary chances? You know. But then he has a particular ritual that's part of his courtship too, that he does specifically to entice the female. It's, you remember that? No, not yet. That's later. What is the ritual?
Not yet. He tries to lure her into a nest, sort of.
Yeah, the. That's right. The coming to the nest display, which Lawrence claims at this stage is purely symbolic. He says it's not a real nesting area. It might not even be a very good nesting area. And yet it makes the nesting call. The zick, 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 zick. That's the way he writes it. I don't know jackdaws, so I can't imitate the sound. I can imitate some bird songs, but only from the area where I grew up. Okay, I'll try that sometime. My throat has to be properly lubricated and everything. And this is. So the calling to the nest ceremony, a symbolic ceremony that he tries to attract the female. And what do you see between the male and the female at that point? How are they looking at each other? It's very interesting because it's so human-like. Yeah.
The male's like staring intently at it, and she's kind of like looking away.
That's right. She always appears to be looking somewhere else, and he is staring right at her, trying to get her attention. That's right. That's right. And how do you know this question here? How does the female respond in a way that signals that she's getting attached to him? It signals an engagement. That they're becoming a couple. Yes.
She squats in front of him and quivers her wings.
Okay. She squats and quivers. He's got a little picture there. She lowers her breast way down, and her neck will go up a little bit. And that is, it's actually the invitation to mating. But at this point, it has nothing to do with mating. At this point, it's a ritual, okay? It's basically giving in to his advances and saying, okay, I'll accept you. So she's making a choice. And it's not that they always will do that. I mean, female jackdaws do make choices, and the male won't always get that far with her, okay? But when he does, that's what she does. And I'm just pointing out that happens 12 months before sexual maturity, so there's no mating involved or anything, okay? Yeah.
He also says that a female jackdaw would never marry someone who's in lower hierarchy than she is. Does that happen with most other species, or most other species that is higher?
It's very common, yes. But you do find some violations of that rule sometimes. even in the jackdaw colony. But let's go on with this coupling behavior, or describe two behaviors that occur frequently between a betrothed or married pair of jackdaws. Betrothed means that year before they start mating, okay, but they're engaged, you know. But once they start mating, then he calls them a married couple. I want to know the behaviors that allow you to identify the couples, and then I want you to tell me how long they stay married. Yes?
Don't they sort of team up if one jackdaw is getting in a fight with another, and the spouse will show up and help?
Exactly. That's one way. If the male gets in a fight, suddenly his female will be there helping him. You know? If she gets in a squabble with another jackdaw, the same thing. He will come to her aid. Okay, that's one way. The other is they have a greeting. The greeting ceremony is often repeated, the same one that indicated that she's accepting him. They do that all the time when they greet each other. And even after they've mated and had young, they still use that as a greeting ceremony. Okay? So it has two different functions. Okay? It can be an invitation to mating, but in this form it's a symbolic greeting gesture. Okay? But there's other... He talks about how when they're with each other, you'll hear many infantile sounds. Sounds that you normally hear only with young jackdaws. The only other time you hear it is between... within a pair like that. Sounds very human-like, doesn't it? Since we do very similar things. How long do they stay paired? Usually for life. He describes a few situations where a pair was upset by an intruding female, for example. Once in a while you get a change, but normally it's for life. They're very monogamous animals. Now, I'm not sure among jackdaws at that time he saw them as permanently monogamous. And now we know that ant birds that are apparently monogamous, that you also have what they call extra pair copulations. So we will talk about that when we talk about sociobiology. And we know more about that now because of genetic studies. Okay, because we can look at the offspring, genes of the offspring. Sometimes, to the surprise of the investigator, they find out that a brood might contain some animals that are the offspring of the mate and some that aren't. Well, sometimes there can be more than one father, depending on the bird. And this varies among bird species. There was a question.
I was going to ask if like one of the jackdaws dies earlier, and the other one's still alive, is it spacing?
They do remate. Yeah, they will take another mate, according to Lawrence, if one of them dies. And of course that does happen. Okay, here I'm just asking about this conflict behavior in jackdaws. Every species of animal has aggressive behavior if they're very social. And I say most conflicts among jackdaws are settled by posturing, these postures that display aggressive intent or defensive intent. They defend their nest sites, and you'll hear this zick, 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 zick behavior sound. It becomes very intense in February and March, where you hear it all over the place in Altenburg, Germany, because there's a lot of jackdaws there. And so I'm asking here, well, what happens if, in spite of all this posturing, a jackdaw actually does attack? And it does happen. It'll happen sometimes with a jackdaw, and once in a while another species will come in and try to, for example, take over a nest site, like a magpie. Well, what happens then? Do they all just back down? Yes?
Other jackdaws join the fight and usually take the side of the different
mate. That's right. You will hear first a change in the sound. He says, the zick, zick, zick changes to a louder yip, 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 and initially it's just a louder zick, zick, and then it changes, so it even sounds different. It's a loud yipping sound that they make, and that has a very interesting function. It attracts the other jackdaws in the colony, and they will literally mob the guy who's offending the rules of society, and they will attack him. And they say that it becomes sort of a confused situation where they're all, you'll hear this loud yip, yip, yipping, and even the initial aggressor will join in. And he'll be looking for the intruder too, you know. So it totally stops the misbehavior and controls the order. This is my last question here, and I will let you go. We're running over a little bit. I just want you to notice very interesting behavior in jackdaws, that an older jackdaw can entice a young wanderer to come back home, and that was very important in his colony because the young jackdaws would be very attracted to flying other groups of jackdaws or even crows who were flying over. They have find it very hard to they like to fly and very hard to resist black forms flying over the house there where he lived, so they would disappear. And yet the older jackdaws would be able to get them to come back in many cases. He thought at first when this happened, he was, all his work was disappearing, gone with the wind, he said. He says actually gone against the wind because they usually fly against the wind. But what happens? When they fly, they have a particular sound. Sort of the joy of flying is accompanied by this, you know, the crow sound. We say caw, caw, and they say kya, kya. And it changes from the kya, kya sound to a kaw. It has a lower sound, lower ending. And when they start making that, it means come on home, fly home. And when they do that and fly, sometimes that sound is just enough of an additional invitation they'll get the young bird to follow when they fly. So they'll follow them to a field where they've all landed to feed with their other birds they've taken off with, and they will come near and they will change their sound and then fly. And that sound plus the sight of the flying jackdaw will often be enough, and they will get the young to come back. And then once it's back, you see, then it's free of all the attraction to the other birds.